Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now onto the episode with your host, Harry Kemsley.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of World of Intelligence by James. Your usual host, Harry Kemsley, and my co-host, Sean Corbett. Hello, Sean.
Morning, Harry. Good to be back.
Good to see you here. So, Sean, some weeks, months ago now, we looked at the situation that was developing in Israel-Gaza. We had a couple of guests in who I'm pleased to say will be back with us very shortly. I'll introduce them. And we said we'd come back and look at the realities that have come to pass in that conflict and that we would discuss where we got to and how we got there in terms of open source intelligence and how we tracked it. So what I thought we'd do today is invite Elliot back in the room and Lewis, and also a colleague from the James team, Jeremy Biddle. So first of all, Lewis, welcome back to the call. Lewis Smart.
Hi there, Harry. Pleased to be here. Yeah, I'm the manager of the Middle East and North Africa country intelligence team at James. Great to be here.
Welcome back, Elliot Chapman.
Morning, Harry. Morning, Sean. Good to be back. Thank you. I'm a senior analyst with the Middle East team, working with Lewis in our country intelligence.
And thank you both coming back for your third helping of the World of Intelligence podcast. And least but not last, or is it last but not least, Jeremy?
thanks, Harry. I'm Jeremy Binney, the Middle East Defence Specialist here at James.
Perfect. Gents, thank you for joining us. All right. Now, one of the things I'd like to look at today is how, from an open source perspective, can we track an ongoing complex environment like we see currently in the Middle East? We'll focus it initially around the Israel-Gaza scenario, as we said we would. Now, there are many, many facets to this crisis. There are many stakeholders, both local and international, state and non-state actors. So it's a really complex environment. What I think would be helpful, though, for the audience is to just situate ourselves about where are we? So, Elliot, I'm going to come to you first. Where are we in the situation? What's happened? When we last spoke, we'd seen the thing develop. We'd understand how we started to track it. What's going on now?
So I think we've seen a kind of quite systematized expansion to the conflict in Gaza over, I think it's probably been several months now since we last spoke. We've seen a really big expansion of the conflict in the southern city of Khan Yunis, which has been led by the 98th Paratroopers Division of the IDF. While operations seem to have slowed down in the north, there's still a large number of IDF personnel deployed there. And we've got a kind of 50-50 divide between approximately 13 brigades kind of divided between the north and the south operating. But the shape is somewhat changed since we last spoke of the conflict. So the characteristics being that really the conflict in Khan Yunis has been led, as I said, by the 98th Paratrooper Division, which has things like a special forces brigade, which is known as the commando brigade. Mm-hmm. And so there seems to be a kind of a more targeted approach, a slowing down really from the IDF in some respects. And we're seeing things like, you know, a more concentrated focus on addressing Hamas's tunnel infrastructure, which appears to be more expansive in Khan Yunis in some respects, with sort of larger command bunkers in some places. And it's also probably fair to say that there's a bit more sensitivity around, at least from the Israelis' perspective, sensitivity around trying to release hostages or at least apply pressure to Hamas, as it is their policy to release hostages, but trying to do so in a way that's not going to endanger those people, because it seems like the IDF is pretty convinced that at least a significant amount of hostages, Israeli hostages, are still in Khan Yunis. So that's kind of what we're seeing, a bit of a slowing down, and kind of looking forward to the very short term, almost immediate term, we're looking at a potential operation in Rafah, in the sort of last city that is yet to see a major ground force enter.
Okay, so when we last spoke, we talked about the fact that you've been tracking the situation in that region for a long time. You could see the indicators of the imminent crisis, although not necessarily the actual invasion of Hamas into Israeli territory, and then how you tracked it through the weeks, days, in fact, the hours into days. I think we talked about in the very first podcast on this. Has there been any shift in the way you've gone about tracking this complex environment since we last spoke?
I think we've kind of moved into a more structured approach to our output. I think initially, it was a matter of kind of collecting as much information and trying to synthesize that into something that was, I guess, consumable for our customers, and, mm-hmm. and not, you know, not just taking masses and massive information and throwing it at people. We've kind of slowly, I think, boiled that down into a more rigorous, I guess, and structured format in our situation reports, which is really now, as the conflict has gone on, you know, we think it's in the interest of our customers to make that as concise and full of only just really important bullet and sort of events and analytical points that you know are relevant to our customers. And of course, we're doing that at a kind of almost global way. It's a large regional focus, of course, but where we've got, you know, European analysts looking at what's happening in Europe and then, you know, in the US as well. So
Lewis, I'm going to come to you in just a moment. I'm going to go to Sean first, but I want to come to you. I just want to talk about how this, as we said, it might, this conflict is spreading into this region of the world. And Lewis just talked about the impacts that might be being tracked now elsewhere. But I'll come back to you in just a second, Lewis, on that point. Sean, when we last spoke on this particular scenario, this particular situation, we talked about how Jane's might be helpful to customers. You were once a customer of Jane's in your previous roles. Obviously, those very organizations will have all eyes, ears on this situation to a great degree. Where does an open source provider continue to help as this conversation matures, as this situation matures, I should say?
Yeah, so for me, I think Elliot really got to the key point straight away, actually. And this is where there's always been a challenge between how you structure yourself as an intelligence organization. Because it's so difficult, we've always done it geographically. Mm-hmm. So the classic case, for instance, is the US operational community. So you've got, you know, CENTCOM and UCOM, for example. And in this scenario, you've got the seam right way between the two. Now, in the past, that would have been a real struggle for them. They're getting a lot better in terms of talking. But for an OSINT organization where it is probably easier in some ways to say, right, this is, it's not just this is my area of responsibility, that, but to cross-fertilize, cross-pollinate and talk to each other across the... So we're looking at thematics as much as we are geographical. And of course, you know, if you've got a relatively small team, you can do that, particularly if you're all sat in the same building.
Yeah.
So it's that awareness of, right, what are you doing? Who else needs to know? Who do I need to talk to bring it all in? Because, I mean, this scenario, and you know, you've heard me say it before, the escalation, you talk maybe about the scale of the escalation, because is it just geographical? Is it, how serious is it? But it's very real. It's actually global. It's not just regional. Yeah. So, you know, you've got to have that agility to be able to bring in other experts.
So, Lewis, let me come to you. As I said, I would. When we last spoke, you were very much looking at the perimeters around this environment and looking at countries close to it. Can you just give us an update from your perspective then on the periphery of this situation, what's going on? And from there, what I'd like to talk about then is, again, how do we track this? How does open source provide us the insights we need for an intelligence purpose to understand this wider dynamic beyond the borders of Gaza?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I'm going to, of course, agree with elements of what Elliot and Sean have said. It became very clear that this wasn't just an Israel-Gaza issue. It became a Lebanon issue. It became a Syria issue. It became an Iraq issue. And then obviously you've got Iran on that periphery. So just to emphasize again, the situation report is a kind of an output where we get all of the different theaters of this conflict onto a report, all of the main important points. But it's also important for OSINT analysts to be aware of what's going on, because what's going on in Iraq is going to impact what's going on in Syria, and the ability of groups and supplies to come through Syria can put pressure on the Lebanese side of this conflict. So yeah, tracking this for an OSINT side and with a team of analysts is we've made sure that we're all on the same page, that we've got that regional input, because and then we've also fused our events team into this conflict, so our events team are also tracking protests across Western cities and Western and other places across the globe, because that will also, as Sean said, it will impact the global dimension, the political opinion, the sentiment, the kind of leeway that the US maybe gives to Israel. So that's just to get us all on the same page. In regards to Iraq and Syria, these are, again, they're distinct theatres, but there's a, you know, there's a joint issue going on. So I know Anand Venkatesh, who covers Iraq, has been following Iraq very closely. We've been following the non-state kind of armed groups who are also political parties, the kind of Shiite coordination framework groups. We've been following their activity closely. They're obviously now under the umbrella term of the Islamic Resistance in Iraq. So we can track them via Telegram. We can track their attacks, their actual attacks against US bases in Iraq. And then we can also track the other groups, the Katayib Sayyid al-Shohuda, Katayib Hezbollah, to see what they're doing, to see what their messaging is, because at times they're very clear in their messaging. They publish it on Telegram, or they publish a political statement following a visit by the IRGC Quds Force commander Ismail Kani, who sometimes goes to Baghdad. So we have to, and it's the same for Syria. In fact, Syria is a lot more difficult because the groups are not as clear. The Iranian-aligned groups operating in Syria, they go under a lot of pseudonyms, a lot of names. They do not message as much as the Iraqi groups in the PMF and as part of the Shiite coordination framework. So Syria is actually a lot more challenging from an OSINT perspective compared to Iraq. So, but regardless, how we cover Iraq, how we cover Syria, it's all part of the team being aware of what's going on and being on the same page. And that will inform analysts like Elliot, who covers Israel, to talk to Siraj, who's covering Syria and Lebanon, to really make sure that they've got what's going on and to discuss the escalatory dynamics between themselves. So, yeah, that's a bit of a broad overview, but I hope that helps.
That does help very much. Sean, I'll come back to you again from this perspective of the customer of Jane's or an open source organization like Jane's. So many organizations you've worked with, I've worked with, will have lots of resources at their disposal, but seldom they have all the capability and capacity they would like to have. So what I think I'm hearing from Lewis and from Elliot is where open source gap fills in this moment of the scenario, where we can look at the flanks in a way that maybe an organization doesn't have the capability or capacity. Probably that is where the open source domain is most helpful in this situation.
I would agree with that up to a point, although the organizations are getting better. But I'll go back to one of my threads that's always there, and I know we're going to do a podcast on this, but is the ability to share intelligence. There are so many actors in this. Is that if you want people to have that awareness, you know, there are certain people you're just not going to share your really big secrets with. So having that open source intelligence, which gives the opportunity to say, right, this is going on, and here's why we know this, when actually they've got confirmation at the more highly classified levels. I would just add one thing, and I haven't been controversial for a while, so I might as well.
That's good.
And that's, you know, and I hope all my buddies within the intelligence community don't take this the wrong way, but that's objectivity. Now, in the intelligence world, because we get the tradecraft wide, and I haven't used that word for two podcasts now, the assessments are objective. But by the time it gets to, dare I say, the political level, there is always going to be a view on, right, how do we shape the environment? So, you know, I go back to the DIME model, which is, the easiest one. So, you know, the sort of diplomatic, information, military and economic. The diplomatic side of things is going to ensure that a certain view is put across. In this case in particular, it is so polarized that you just get opinions everywhere. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to think is from an organization such as James, which is responsible open source intelligence provider and uses very key tradecraft, is that you get just that completely objective view. This is what we're seeing is happening. This is what we think based on the evidence. Now, again, I'm not saying that the intelligence community doesn't do that, but because we're almost standalone and are not getting either senior military or political, you know, input and therefore the unconscious bias, maybe we can have that thread of complete objectivity,
yes,
stretching it. But I think that is an issue.
Interesting. Jeremy, I'm going to bring you into the conversation at this point, because one of the things that an organization like ourselves frequently gets asked about is the equipment engaged in conflict. Now, in non-state armed groups, where they often don't have rigorous hierarchies, very organized, orders of battle, it can become quite complicated. But nonetheless, what's happening in the Red Sea right now is of acute interest to both economic and, of course, therefore military forces that have been deployed. How does an organization like Jane's begin to understand the equipment that's being used by, for example, the Houthi rebel shipping attacks? How do we begin to do that?
Yeah, it's not that easy, Harry. I mean, essentially, I've been looking at this for many years.
Sure.
So how
basically going back to 2015 when the Saudi-led coalition launches their military operation against the Houthis in the wake of their takeover in Sana'a, announcing the government there. And at that stage, the Saudis were essentially saying, we need to do this because this is an Iranian-backed group.
Yeah.
And then to a certain extent, after that, we begin to see all the Iranian weapons flow in. So, and what I do a lot of is looking at all the photos and the videos and stuff that come out of that conflict. And so that might just be sort of general battlefield stuff, which isn't very official, or the official stuff that they... Houthis and Zarala is releasing, and you can say, okay, well, we're already beginning to see some of the Iranian 50 caliber sniper rifle turning up with the Houthis, and then looking at what the photos of the weapon shipments that are seized in the Gulf of Oman, generally speaking, and saying, okay, so this is what is being delivered. Then have a look at what the Saudis are showing us in terms of, we found this, this was launched into our kingdom, and go, okay, well, that looks like this. And then you begin to build up slowly. I mean, I think a lot of, and I'm sure a lot of other people out there will agree with me when they say, like, open source military intelligence tends to sort of bleed out slowly little fragments of information that need to be built up into a more conclusive picture. So this takes a very long time. And then we build up this picture. But over the last couple of years, on the 21st of September anniversaries, the Houthis had these great big parades, and just going through those and saying, right, what is this actually equipped? They're calling it one thing. Can we marry that up to something Iranian? And quite often we can. But one of the really interesting things, I think, is that actually we've seen Iranian gear in Yemen before we've seen it in Iran. So actually the Houthis are telling us quite a lot about Iranian capabilities. And we can say, well, they probably didn't come up with this cruise missile themselves. It's almost certainly Iranian. The Iranians have got this, but we don't, you know, they've never actually displayed it. So then it becomes very important to understand what the capabilities of this cruise missile is. So we can then fit that into our understanding of Iran's strategic capabilities.
So, Sean, I'm definitely coming to you with that, because one of the things that you and I've spoken about before is where open source can help. And one of the things we talked about previously is open source can be a persistent eye looking at things over an extended period. Jeremy's just talked about effectively looking at this situation for the last 8 or 9 years. Isn't that where the open source environment can be of particular help? Because I remember the huge gaps in intelligence that we would face. We'd be told, we're going to go to an operation in this part of the world. And we had little more than a local roadmap of that part of the world and needed to be uploaded with foundational intelligence. Isn't that exactly what the open source environment could do by having that enduring professional look?
Yeah, yes, indeed. And that's back to, you know, where we started all this. I mean, what is the value of open source intelligence at the time? It was mainly on the foundational side. If you're looking at something for a long time, but particularly on the equipment side, where you've got, you know, real experts like Jeremy that understands different mods and all the rest of it. And, you know, I go back, it's a long time now, and I'll probably get sacked now for you saying this, but, you know, the James All the World, whatever piece of equipment it is, were absolutely the reference documents. And whilst things have moved on massively, there still are the reference documents, but in a different, an electronic way. So, you know, unless you've got huge amounts of resource within, you know, the intelligence community that's just looking at equipment intelligence, and there are some organizations that do this, then you're just not going to get that granularity to know what is different, what has changed. You know, as has just been said, when you're seeing new bits of kit in somewhere you're not necessarily expecting it to be, you've got to have that deep understanding, right? Okay, this is a mod of something that actually is produced there, but we're seeing it here. What does that mean?
Yeah.
So that's where, you know, back to that foundational piece.
Sorry, did you want to say?
Well, I just like to add that, to this, you know, imagery is absolutely crucial in terms of just building up the database. This is what we saw when. And then that gives you, when some new imagery comes out, you know, you see a new picture of this missile, you can go back and compare that. And it's a sort of essentially a game of spot the difference. And you could say, okay, well, now it's got a slightly different engine on it or something like that. Or you can see how the different sections that make up the missile are slightly different lengths to suggest there might be more fuel tank and less warhead or something like that. Just building up really extensive imagery files, what was seen when,
right,
and sourcing that transparently. And then you can really, over the years, begin to build up an understanding of how these things have evolved and where they're turning up in different places.
I'm intrigued by the point you made earlier, Jeremy, about the idea that we might infer what's back in Iran by what they've deployed into Yemen and what we've seen there. That's something that perhaps we can come back to in a second. What I'd like to do now, though, is move on to what's actually quite a difficult topic, but it relates to this point about where open source can be helpful in itself and to organizations we're partnered with. There's a lot of discussion in open media about the activity of Iran in relation to this situation in the Middle East. It's been described by some as sub-threshold, meaning it's not overt activity, it's very much under the radar. How does open source intelligence, and I come to each of you from your perspective, so, you know, in your terms, Elliot, what are you seeing that gives you confidence that Iran is absolutely directly involved in this, but perhaps sub-threshold? I'll do the same for you, Lewis, in terms of that more regional perspective, and then I think we'll come back to that point you just made, Jeremy, in terms of how we can see the weapons arriving and whether they're Iranian or not. So this sub-threshold piece, when I've gone around the room, I think probably Sean, I need to come back to you again to say, so from what you've heard, how useful is that to the environment that can see things more classified? So sub-threshold tracking, how do we do that?
Well, I think from my perspective, we've done an interesting piece recently on, you know, really if you want to talk about the sub-threshold, we've been looking at financing as really, you know, that's a foundational piece of Iran's influence in the region, and recently done quite a good job of building up an overall picture of maybe what you describe as Hamas's budget, okay, at least for sort of on an annualized basis. And Iran, unsurprisingly, is a big part of that. There's some intelligence, or rather information, being released from Gaza that indicates that Iran is involved in supplying money to Hamas. But there's lots of other pre-existing information that we have as well to kind of build up that picture. And really, it looks like Iran has sought to finance really Hamas's military capabilities in Gaza. Obviously, money's an important thing for Hamas, you know, as a broader organization. And there's a lot of, let's call it, cynicism around the leadership of Hamas and their relationship with money, leading quite extravagant lives. And clearly, Iran has tried to avoid potentially funding that lifestyle in Qatar, and really is invested in sort of perhaps what you'd call Hamas's or the Qassam Brigade's strategic capabilities, so tunnels, weapons manufacturing facilities, that kind of thing in Gaza, which are now proving to be the kind of the defining capability that Israel is at least publicly saying that this is what we need to tackle, in order to undermine the Qassam Brigade's capabilities. And
just to dig a little bit further on that point. So what are the indicators that you're using? Because open source is seldom definitive. It's always, as Jeremy said, described earlier, a jigsaw puzzle you're building, bringing together these little tiny bits of information to build a picture. Give me a couple of examples of things that you would see as being indicators of the things you talk about regarding finance, for example.
I think, you know, money seizures, for example, something that we did in our recent piece was looking at cryptocurrency seizures, which indicate where wallets have been registered in what countries, so we can sort of build up a picture of an international donation system that's looking at, in this case, online cryptocurrency wallets that are basically being used to raise and then transfer money to us.
Fascinating. All right, that does sound interesting. I won't dig too much deeper on that, though, because we've got other things to talk about. So, Lewis, again, sub-threshold activity of a country like Iran and these various aspects of this complex environment.
Yeah, absolutely. So Iran acts through its proxies. Iran, it doesn't want a direct conflict with the US, or it very, very likely does not want a direct conflict with the US. From an OSINT side as well, it's obviously very unlikely that we're going to get access to IRGC comms or their operation rooms through Iraq and Syria. That is the preserve of the intelligence agencies through ELINT, SIGIN, HUMAN, etc. So we have to track Iran in a large way through its proxies, as I kind of mentioned earlier. So looking at the actions of its proxies in Iraq and Syria, but more so Iraq, it gives us a really good idea potentially of what Iran is seeking to achieve here. So Iran, and from its actions in Iraq so far, it seems like, one, that they are putting immense pressure on US forces based in Iraq with the multitude of attacks and UAV attacks on American forces and bases there. Now we're talking about, and there's a dialogue going on at the moment between the US and Iraqi government officials about potential withdrawal or setting a timetable for withdrawal of US forces from Iraq. So we can start to deduce here that this is a point of pressure potentially for Iran to put pressure on the US forces in Iraq to gain political advantage in that country, while also being cognizant of what's going on in Israel and Gaza. So we do have to track it through its proxies. And those proxies, we should never fully say, and Jeremy can probably speak to this on the Houthis, is it's never just that a proxy is doing the 100% bidding of Iran and its master. There will always be its own self-interest. So the Shiite coordination framework, which maybe is a different podcast, but has basically taken over the Iraqi state to a large extent since the Muhammad Shia al-Sudani took over. But so there's a game going on Iraq, and we have to look at Iran's influence. When does Khani visit Baghdad at critical points? When does he say, or when can we kind of have a higher confidence that there's a high likelihood that Khani is now saying to these groups that hold off on these attacks because we don't want to draw the US in further in a more direct conflict? So Iran will be using its proxies for its own goals, and it's through OSINT we can track that a lot through its groups and those proxies who are on the open sources. So that's an Iraq example there, maybe.
Yeah, very good. Jeremy, let me come to you then with the Houthis. How are we seeing Iranian influence from an open source perspective? What are the lenses we can put on that to see it?
Thanks, Harry. What we know is the Iranians are supplying some really quite sophisticated weaponry to some of the allied groups in the Middle East, and that's not just the Houthis. So sure. Recently we've seen one of their cruise missiles was recovered in Babel province in Iraq, for example. And what we also know is there was what the Americans now call a close-in ballistic missile attack on Ayn al-Assad Air Base in Iraq as well. So it's not just the Houthis are getting these. We've also probably seen the Hezbollah using the Iranian non-line of sight anti-tank guided weapon on Israeli positions on the Lebanese border. Mm. So it's not just the Houthis, but the Houthis really are where we see some of the more strategic stuff coming in. And what we know is that from weapon seizures, they don't come in as whole weapons. They come in components.
Right.
So these have to be assembled in country. So they need someone in Yemen to know how to assemble them. And they need someone in Yemen who knows how to use them. So we're definitely looking at a high level of Iranian training, whatever. The extent that the Iranians then have operational control over these weapons is open to debate. You would imagine that if they're supplying these weapons which have the ability to hit Abu Dhabi or Riyadh or even the Lat now, then the Iranians would want a big say about how those are used.
Sure.
So you've got to imagine they have significant influence over that. Every so often, though, perhaps, and this is where we maybe have to pull in our political colleagues, saying, is that really in Iran's interest to do that attack? And then perhaps we need to bring in another perspective to say, are the Houthis being more belligerent here? Because sometimes they do seem to be. Mm-hmm. And if you want a recent example, you got one yesterday. Mm-hmm. So they attacked a ship that was heading from Brazil to Iran, carrying Brazilian corn. Now that might well have been a mistake. And then, but it's and one of the interesting things about that is the Iranian cargo ship that is suspected of being out there spotting initially in the Red Sea and then moved over to the Gulf of Aden. But that has since moved into Djibouti. So perhaps the Iranian ship was accidentally attacked because the Iranian spotter ship is not currently operational because it's harbouring itself in Djibouti. So lots of interesting questions. I think personally, it's quite a difficult question to answer from Austin, and that's probably when clients will, you know, try and bring in their, probably especially their communications intelligence and understanding which members of the IRGC are actually in Yemen and how they're actually directly influencing the process in terms of, do they have guys on the ground with these launches, or are they sitting back in an operational room saying, yes, that's okay by us?
Right.
So it's very difficult for us at that level to get a good insight. But what we obviously can infer from it to a certain degree is that certainly the Iranians are almost certainly exercising a high degree of influence over how a lot of these weapons are being used around the Middle East.
Perfect. Lewis?
Yeah, just a quick point on something Jeremy said. I think that, you know, there's the, as Sean mentioned earlier, there's the ability to share OSINT across intelligence agencies, which is one of its values. One of the values that we've learned internally, I think, since this conflict broke out is doing it ourselves. Right. So it's tradecraft and it's red teaming and it's bringing in different perspectives. And it's even gets across the vertical and horizontal. Right. So the vertical is the grand strategic, operational and tactical. And then the horizontal is different thematics and teams. You know, we've always talked to Jeremy. I'm a big fan of Jeremy's work, but I've never talked more to Jeremy and my team have never talked more to Jeremy since covering this conflict. And his OSINT helps our OSINT, and we can cover that vertical and horizontal axes for customers who can then share that with their customers. So just a quick point that I wanted to raise.
Yeah, thank you very much. So Sean, pivoting back to yourself then, back in the room behind the vault door, you just heard how an open source environment at the tactical, regional, and in the weapons environment, for example, might be playing a part here. How does that sound to you in terms of its value?
So the first thing to say is it's an incredibly challenging subject, this. So it's got to be a full team sport.
Yep.
So you need all sources, whether that is the super secret stuff that's been alluded to, which there will be a huge amount of effort, you know, because that is one of the key questions. To what extent, not just is, but to what extent is Iran, you know, actually directing, supporting, you know, or encouraging, you know, or combinations of all of the above. So no one organization can do it on its own. What I'd like to think, which is probably not the case, is that economy of effort, because there's so much to get on, is that instead of the organizations doing their own open source intelligence, which some will be trying to do, no question about that, and there will be a huge amount of duplication, it's, if we can foster that trust and that, all right, you can do that, and actually you can do it really well, rather than us within the intelligence community say, okay, now we've got to develop tradecraft specifically for this, or understand how to, you know, do the clever stuff that we do to keep things in the financial stuff and understanding that, then bringing that all together would be the way ahead. Does that happen right now? I would suggest to a limited extent, and I'd also suggest that many intelligence organizations are trying to do it themselves.
Yeah.
How successfully remains to be seen. So it's back to what you were saying before, it's only one piece of the jigsaw, and I would never say that, you know, open source intelligence is able to provide a better picture or a more complete picture than the intelligence, because that's certainly not the case. But they give, and someone else mentioned it earlier, in the open source side, we can give a different perspective from looking at it from different lens and looking at it from, you know, the perspective of having looked at it for a long time from a, you know, these are the feeds we've got compared to these are the feeds you've got.
Yeah. All right, gentlemen, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring the conversation to a conclusion. I'm going to ask you all to give the audience one takeaway that you want them to hear from you, from your perspective, about the power and utility of open source information to derive intelligence. The one I'm taking away from this conversation is actually leaning on a couple of points, particularly the one that Jeremy made earlier, about the amount of time it takes to gather sufficient insights, which might be fragmentary insights, but by expertise, experience, and duration, you bring them together and a picture starts to form. Of course, that picture now becomes something that you test against alternative perspectives. But for me, that probably is one of the most powerful uses of the open source environment, if you have the right tradecraft, the right expertise, and enough time to try and build the kind of pictures, Jeremy, that you've picked up on from a standing start, would be almost impossible, frankly. I think that for me is probably the big takeaway. So just working around the room, because Jeremy's next to me, what would be the one takeaway for you, Jeremy, you'd want the audience to hear?
Well, I think we had a good example of the utility of what we do, Harry, just the other day when the on this subject, which is when the US Defense Intelligence Agency released a report on basically comparing uranium to Hoopy weapons. And essentially that was all built around open source. Mm. And a fair amount of it was James. And essentially what that did was validate what we'd already done, because they reached the same conclusions that we did.
Right.
But the important thing from the DIA's point of view is that they can put that all out there into open sources without actually compromising any of their
The shareability.
Clandestine sources.
Yeah.
So they're educating the public using open sources that have been working on this subject for a long time.
Yes.
And they haven't compromised any of their own intelligence sources.
Very good. I like that. That picks up on the point that you made a while ago, Lewis. I'll come to you next about the shareability of the open source intelligence. So, Lewis, your takeaway for the day.
Yeah, it builds on that. And I think it references that vertical and horizontal kind of integration of teams and OSINT capabilities and professions. Like I said, there's defense insight, there's country intelligence, James, now, and us being able to fuse those two big OSINT pictures is something I think we're getting better at. But I think it's something we'll increasingly provide value to customers. Every organization and team will fight bureaucratic stovepipes, inertia, all of that stuff. But I think we've hopefully got to a better stage where we're integrating that vertical and horizontal levels. And hopefully that will provide a more in-depth and holistic OSINT picture for customers.
I guess it's through that integration, vertical and horizontal, that the fragmentary elements of the open source environment start to fuse into the insight that we want to use for intelligence purposes.
Yeah.
Elliot?
I guess to add maybe start another different perspective, I'd say speed is an important part. You know, almost not to contradict what Jeremy's saying, I think actually the two sides of the same coin, in the sense that, you know, we spent many years building up a really good sort of understanding of how things work, and that's represented in our, you know, group profiles, our military capabilities profiles, etc. And so when things start happening really fast, we have a kind of foundational, easily accessible reference material to go and say, well, can Israel go and attack southern Lebanon right now? Like, well, let's look at the Orbat, like how many units are tied up in Gaza, how, you know, et cetera, that type of thing. And so rather than just kind of throwing around possibilities, we have an ability to, I think, take information in quickly and then reference it against existing.
That's an interesting takeaway. That because we spent so long looking at something, to Jeremy's point, it allows us to react quickly to identify what's a real threat or a real problem.
Yeah, yeah. And particularly in a James kind of environment where there's all these different content or reference or data sets or whatever you want to call them, you can sort of look at different things. Maybe I'm reinforcing Lewis's point, but you can kind of say, well, okay, here's a theory. Let's test that against pre-existing knowledge that we have. It might not be my knowledge. It might be someone else's, you know, that they've codified in a profile or something.
I like that very much. Thank you. Sean, the last word, as always.
So a lot of what I was going to say has been said, but I think my key takeaway is that, you know, nothing happens in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has consequences and implications. And in this case, as in many, you know, how far does it go? What that means is that it is, and I don't want to trivialize it at all, but it's a team sport.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people talk about all source intelligence. We'll use all source intelligence, and that includes open source as well as, the good stuff, if you like. And the only way you can do that is by having the agility, but also being, you know, and that's really what I mentioned before, you've got to have a thematic as well as geographical view and have that agility to be able to bring everything together.
Yeah, very good. All right, I'm going to pull stumps on the conversation there. Gentlemen, thank you, as always, for your contribution and expertise. For me, I think one of the sad things about this situation is how quickly it has escalated. One of the worrying things about the situation is how quickly it is escalating. But perhaps by using the kind of tradecraft we talked about today, we'll see that coming in a way that might be helpful to start to reverse the escalation and get us to a place where we start to see the horrors of what's happening in that world start to cease and reduce. Thank you all for your time. It's very, very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, janes.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.